we have such a high rate of HIV transmissions in the South. And I wanted to make sure that I was a voice for the voiceless, for people who couldn't be open about their status.
We've come a long way since the first World AIDS Day in 1988, but not far enough. It's Thursday, December 1st, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today, what would a price cap on Russian oil mean for your wallet and for the war in Ukraine? And freight rail workers aren't the only ones who have to fight for sick pay. First, today on this World AIDS Day, the head of the UN AIDS program acknowledged that the world is not on track to eradicate AIDS by the end of the decade, as had been previously promised. The main reason why? Inequality. Here in the U.S., the states with the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses are in the South, and cases are spreading particularly fast among Black women. Marnina Miller lives in Houston and has HIV. She told Robin Young she's working to smash the stigma as part of her work with the Southern AIDS Coalition.
Well, and I have to say, because I came up during the huge epidemic of the 1980s when AIDS first presented itself and nobody knew what HIV, which is the virus that leads to the full-blown disease of AIDS. No one knew what it was. And I envisioned an older woman who'd maybe been living with HIV from that time for decades. But you are a very young woman, and I get a walking symbol of how HIV is still being contracted.
Yes, ma'am. I myself contracted HIV in college. I am a millennial. And so I contracted HIV around 9 years ago.
Yeah. And you talk very openly about how you contracted it. Now, I have to say there was a very strong debate here in our office about whether that was an important factor in speaking to someone with HIV. Because, you know, back in the day, you know, people used to be shamed about some sort of activity they did unbeknownst to them, you know. And that's because people want to distance themselves. Oh, you did this, and I couldn't possibly do that. You're very open about, you know, how you contracted it. Tell us why, and then we'd love to hear your story.
So the reason why I'm so open and vulnerable with my status is because as a Black woman and living in the South and living with HIV, like you stated, the rate of HIV has really impacted us in a different way as Black women. We have such a high rate of HIV transmissions in the South, and I wanted to make sure that I was a voice for the voiceless, for people who couldn't be open about their status due to HIV stigma.
Yeah, in their families, in their community. And you can talk about that too, but first, you were a freshman in college, dating a guy, you were dating for a little bit, you guys liked each other. Pick up the story.
We decided to go ahead and have sex, as most young folks do, and we didn't use a condom one day, and I felt a little weird about it. So afterwards, the next day, I said, hey, you know, maybe we should schedule some time to go to the clinic. So about a month later, we decided to go to the health department together, and both of our tests came back positive.
Well, and what happened to him?
He told me that he was not the one who I contracted HIV from, but I knew that he was the only sexual partner that I have had since my last pap smear and my last HIV test, and we ended up not speaking ever again.
Well, and so I'm thinking a couple things. First of all, he's out there dating, most likely, and government statistics show that 13% of the approximately 1.2 million people living with HIV in the U.S. don't know they have it. That's why it can spread so easily. He presumably does at this point, but his partners may not. Do you think about that?
I do think about that, but I think my biggest thing that I think about is the 1.2 million people who are living with HIV. And there is a huge community of support that I have been lucky to be around and that I have gotten so much wisdom and knowledge from that I really lean on my support systems now.
Yeah, well, and we want to talk about being positive, about being HIV positive, which you do so beautifully. But I'm assuming this is also a cautionary tale for kids you talk to. You were careful. You had HIV testing, pap smears too. You were wearing protection and then a couple of times didn't. I'm sure when you tell that to young people who maybe aren't thinking of any of those things, it makes an impact.
Yes, as a millennial, when I talk to younger people about living with HIV, I'm very honest with them, and I equip them with the tools not only to prevent themselves from contracting HIV, but I also let them know about condom usage. I let them know about PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a once-day pill that they can take to prevent themselves from contracting HIV, whether they do know or don't know their partner's status. And I also let them know that this is no longer a death sentence, but I do let them know the grim statistics that over 50% of all new HIV diagnoses are in the southern United States.
Yeah. Well, and you also let us know, you know, you're on TikTok, you've got videos that not only is there a stigma about HIV that you wanted to override, there's also a stigma about being gay in your family in the South. And you were discovering that that was you as well. You kind of came out in that way as well.
Yes, I did, Robin. I really wanted to talk about the fact that homophobia and transphobia is still a huge issue in the Deep South. My parents were not wanting me to date a woman. They didn't want me to identify as queer. And so when I did go off to college, I did date a guy and ended up contracting HIV. And for so long, I blamed my parents. But once I looked at the statistics and all of the factors around HIV, I really knew that me being younger, me being a Black woman in the South, made me more susceptible to an HIV diagnosis, unfortunately.
Well, you talked about a pill you can take that helps prevent HIV. You decided to seek treatment to live with HIV. Talk about some of the things, because we see in these ads on TV about medications to help people live longer, injections. Talk about some of the things that you want people to know about.
So as a person living with HIV, I take one pill once a day. There are also shots that you can take as well, that you can go to the doctor and it's one shot once a month. And so the reason why we take medication is so that we won't acquire acquired immunodeficiency syndrome.
Right. It stays as a virus inside you. So it sounds like your message is prevention, you know, be clear-eyed about prevention. But once you've contracted, if you have contracted HIV, you can live.
Yes, definitely. Not only can you live, but you can also thrive. I know people that are living with HIV that are doing amazing work all throughout this country and are living long, healthy lives.
Yeah. Well, Marnina Miller, Community Outreach Coordinator for the Southern AIDS Coalition, a woman living with HIV, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've got more stories on this World AIDS Day at hereandnow.org, including a trip to the National AIDS Memorial Grove in San Francisco, the only federally recognized memorial of its kind, and a conversation with the author of Hidden Mercy, AIDS, Catholics, and the Untold Story of Compassion in the Face of Fear. Head to hereandnow.org for those stories and a lot more. Coming up next, a price cap for Russian oil could be on the way. Stick around. European leaders are preparing to kneecap Russia's oil business by limiting how much buyers can pay for oil from Russian producers. That might push up the price of gas, which just hit its lowest level in the U.S. since the beginning of the war in Ukraine back in February. Ali Velshi is an anchor and economics correspondent for MSNBC. He stopped by to talk to Scott Tong about it.
Okay, so a barrel of crude oil, if I went out and bought one in the world market right now, I'd have to pay like $80-something. But the EU wants Russian oil to sell for much lower than that. How would that work?
Yeah, so the EU, the 27 members of the EU would like Russian oil. They agreed that starting December 1st, they'd like to limit the price that they pay for Russian oil to 62 barrels a week. Now, there isn't even agreement about that because Poland, Estonia, and Lithuania, three NATO countries that were former Soviet republics that do not, or under Soviet influence, that do not want to continue to help Russia profit from its oil exports, would like it to be lower. Some of them want it to be $30 a barrel. Here's the problem. If you take Russian oil off the world market, the price of oil skyrockets, right? We've all dealt with these high oil prices, high gas prices for a while. So the United States stepped in and said, why don't we call it $60 a barrel? And the problem with that is that not everybody wants to go along with it. They want to be able to have Russian oil on the market so that global prices don't skyrocket, but not have Russia profit from it too much. That's why they want to put a cap on how much Russia can sell its oil for.
Yeah, well, you know how complicated energy markets are, and you kind of mess with them at your peril. I mean, do we know where this is going to go? As you were saying, there's a possibility that if Russia pulls its oil or Russian oil disappears from the market, there's not enough, and then prices go up for all of us.
Yeah, and so there are several wild cards, one of which is just the market, right? How will people react to it? But China and India are big, big, big buyers of Russian oil, and both of them have signaled that they don't like this interference in the market. India continues to say, we'll buy Russian oil, we'll buy oil from anywhere, you know, we need to buy oil from. And both of those countries are big, big, big consumers of oil. So the danger here is the whole thing backfires, and that's why the United States has gotten involved and said, let's not go for too low a price cap, because the Russians just won't participate. If there's a $30 price cap on Russian oil, the Russians may just decide, let's not sell oil. There's also other parts of this legislation in Europe which will penalize shippers and insurers. So the U.S. is trying to come to this place that says, look, $60 a barrel is enough that Russia can still make some money in producing and exporting oil, not so much that they'll make as much as they're making right now, and not so low that it'll take that Russian oil off the market and make prices for everyone else skyrocket. But as you said, Scott, this is a market, so it's very, very complicated to know how actions like this will actually, how they'll play out in the world market.
Okay, and really quickly, this plan the U.S. is proposing, this kind of Goldilocks sanction on Russian oil,
right,
is it going to move forward?
It probably is. There are three holdouts in the EU out of 27 countries right now. Maybe the price won't be $62 a barrel. Maybe they'll get it, like, you know, $57 a barrel. It will probably move forward, though. There will probably be a cap instituted on December 7th on the price that Russian oil can be paid for.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
After the break, freight rail workers are fighting for a few days of sick leave. They currently have none. Whether they get it is up to Congress. We check in on the history of labor activism in the freight rail industry and what it tells us about today. Stick around.
With the addition of just 4 paid sick days off, this tentative agreement would ratify our rank and file. Yeah. It wouldn't even have to be imposed.
That's Clark Ballew with the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, one of the unions fighting for sick pay for freight rail workers. He's referring to a resolution passed by the House yesterday that forces rail unions to sign the current contract with no paid sick days. The House also passed a separate resolution, adding 7 days of paid sick leave. The Senate now picks that up. Now, you might be wondering why rail workers who do dangerous physical labor have no paid sick leave. Well, they're not alone. An estimated 33 million American workers don't have sick days either. Some states like California have a statewide policy, but COVID-related federal sick leave requirements expired in December 2020. Joe McCartan knows all about this. He runs the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown. He spoke to Robin Young.
And to start, we just should note that you are one of dozens of professors who signed on to a letter to President Biden weighing in on this debate. What did you want to say?
That's right. Well, we were pointing out that for a long time, for more than a century, what happens to railroad workers in this country tends to set the tone for what happens to other workers. And in this particular case, this demand for paid sick days by these railroad workers raises an issue that's going to affect many workers, that already affects many workers in the United States, many of whom don't have paid sick days, as you point out. About 25% of Americans don't have that right now, and many of them do essential work, like these rail workers. And so what we pointed out is that in the past, presidents have used their power to either help improve labor conditions by dealing with what is happening to railroad workers, or suffer their further erosion. For example, in 1916, Woodrow Wilson signed a bill that gave railroad workers an 8-hour workday, and that set the tone that allowed other workers to win that.
And when it comes to the sick days, just give us a little bit of the history of that. Where did the sick day come from?
Well, the sick day has been a thing that workers have fought for decades and decades. And it was especially in the post-war era, that unions were strong enough to be able to bargain for paid sick days. And as you point out about the labor movement, what it has been able to win for its workers has been able to translate out to others. Probably listeners have seen the bumper sticker at one point or another, the labor movement, the folks who bought you the weekend.
Yeah.
And in fact, the labor movement's struggles have helped to shape what all workers get.
Yeah. Do you have a date there or around a date when paid sick days came into being?
It depended on industry, by industry, how workers were able to fight for and to get paid sick days. In fact, some what were called welfare capitalist employers in the 1920s, more progressive employers began offering these sick days in the aftermath of labor upheavals in World War I. So the 1920s was a time when you started to see the first evidence of paid sick days being won.
Yeah, and I would think that a paid sick day isn't just benevolence, although it's a nice thing to grant workers. Mm-hmm. It feels as if it would help your production line, help disease from spreading. I mean, what's the thinking behind it?
Oh, absolutely. Over time, studies have shown time and again that when paid sick days are in force, it contributes to the efficiency of the whole system and to the, you know, the stability of a company. And that's really the rub of what's going on right now in the rail industry, because it's set up a business model in the past 10 years especially that has really tried to take all the flexibility out of the workforce as a way of improving profits. It's a short-term strategy for jacking up profits, but in the long term, it makes the system a lot less resilient.
Yeah. Well, and we understand in staying with the rail workers, that part of the problem, workers have told us, is that a paid sick day, this idea of a day that you suddenly take because you get sick, is tied to something else the rail companies have been doing, which is called just-in-time scheduling. Talk about that.
Yes. Yes. In the railroad industry, it's got a specific name called precision scheduled railroading, and it's a version of a just-in-time scheduling thing that many of your listeners will be familiar with in their own jobs. In the railroad industry, basically, it's a strategy to do what in the old days in New England textile mills, for example, workers used to call the speed-up and the stretch-out, running a power loom more quickly and then trying to do it with fewer workers. So where a worker used to tend two looms, they now had to tend three. It boosted company profits in the short term, but at the expense of the workers' safety and health very often. Yeah. So in the railroad industry, what they've tried to do is to run their trains with fewer workers. Over the past 6 years, they've reduced their crews by 30%. And that requires a lot more stress for the workers who remain. One of the ways the companies have dealt with how do you run this system with fewer workers is to make the trains longer, bigger. And so where you might have had 250-car trains, the employers have moved to one 100-car train, and you need half the number of workers to run it. Yeah. Now, when you do that kind of thing in the system, you take a lot of the slack out of it that used to exist. It really helps company profits, but you can't really tolerate anybody being sick because there's nobody to fill in for them if they are. And that's the problem that workers are trying to call people's attention to.
Yeah, but we've proven as a country that we can do it when we understand the need. We had some mandated paid sick leave passed by Congress during COVID, but that was allowed to lapse.
It worked as well, right? It helped to restrain the pandemic. And yet, yes, it did lapse. But, you know, that experiment worked very well.
Yeah. Look, we are not unsympathetic to companies trying to, you know, stay afloat, make a profit, which their workers will benefit from. But as an historian who's looked at this, you know, what's the cost benefit? I mean, you know, some would say, well, maybe this isn't a time. We all hear about the supply chain being held up. We know about inflation. Make the case that this would be cost beneficial to them.
Well, you know, it would be in the long term. The problem is that many businesses think about the next quarterly report and the impact it will have on stock prices. And what they've found is in the past 10 years, they've doubled their profit as they've moved to this new model of scheduling. So last year, the seven biggest North American railways had a combined net income of $27 billion. They could take some of that money and they could, you know, reduce the stress on the workers by offering sick days, by having more people on staff in these crews. But in the short term, they're able to squeeze out this profit, and there are plenty of activist investors who are pushing them to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they could still enjoy a very healthy profit and still address the workers' needs here. But I think what we see in this particular case is an example of greed. They can get more out of workers in this current system, and so they're trying to get more.
Joe McCartin, Executive Director of the Kamanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown. Joe, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We want to hear from you about your experiences with sick leave. Have you ever needed sick leave and been denied by your employer? Have you put off doctor's appointments or treatments? Maybe not been able to attend to a sick loved one because of your job's lack of sick pay? Tell us about it. We might share your story on the podcast or on the radio. Record a short voice memo on your phone and send it to letters@hereandnow.org. This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hereandnow.org, for more stories, including a look at what Morehouse College calls the first metaversity, where students can learn Black history through virtual reality headsets.
It gives you an experiential experience, especially when you own that bridge in Selma in 1965, and you can get an experience on how the civil rights marches felt, especially when they came over the bridge and saw the police.
Head to hereandnow.org for that one. And hey, if you're scrolling through Spotify dissecting your year-end Wrapped, why not take a minute to give this podcast a rating if you like what you've been hearing? We're also on Apple Podcasts and very much appreciate your ratings there, too. Thanks. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Thomas Danielian, and Gabrielle Healy. Todd Munt and Peter O'Dowd edited the show. Technical direction today from Caleb Green and Mike Moschetto. Theme music by me, Mike, and Max Liebman. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.